The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we're going to play a really personal and wide-ranging interview I did with Melissa Etheridge. She talks about her entire career from the very beginning, including the writing of some of her best-known songs, the time she spent with Bruce Springsteen, being in the closet early on, and having almost no one ever ask her about it, and her very intense and life-changing experience with cannabis. We also, of course, talk about the personal tragedy she recently experienced. Let's get right to that interview.
Melissa, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
When I listen to your music, when I listen to your voice, when I listen to your songwriting, I hear a lot of things, but one thing I've always heard is strength. I think you project that in a million ways. You have a song called Love Will Live on your most recent album. And it's about a very different kind of trauma, but you know, you say, I did not shatter, did not crumble, didn't die, I've chosen to live. I'm no longer down, I am so much stronger now, I've got so much to give. And I think you've overcome a lot. I wanted to start by offering condolences on a loss I can't even imagine.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And I don't know how you're doing all you're doing now in the face of that loss. And I don't. And the only reason I would ask is maybe you have something to share that might help other people as far as being able to move on.
Yeah. Well, I realized I started thinking a long time ago that maybe things weren't happening to me. Maybe they were happening for me. You know, maybe this was the path that I needed to walk, you know, starting with, you know, just being gay and trying to make it in this world with, you know, as a female, you know, as a lesbian rock star, you know, that first thing, and then cancer, and then, you know, losing my son. That's probably the hardest, deepest wound or cut. But as a mother of someone who was addicted to opioids, it's a struggle. You want to help your child. You want to make them all better. He was a young adult. There were things out of my control, of course. And there came a time that I needed to really sit down with myself and say, I can't save him. I can't give up my life and go try to live his life for him. And I had to come up against the possibility that he might die. And I had to be okay. Not okay, but I had to be able to go on living. Of course, it's nothing a parent ever wants. But as a human being, I needed to... I just needed to be at peace with a troubled son who did the best he could, who, you know, believed what he believed, and his life ended, you know, way, way too soon. You know, there'll always be that place in my heart, in my soul that, you know, that has a little bit of, oh, what could I have done? And, you know, and is it my fault he ended this way, and all that sort of thing. And it just gets smaller and smaller because it doesn't serve me anymore. And where he is now, he certainly doesn't want me to take that on. So if that can help any parent who might be torturing themselves with that, you know, I hope so. It's, you know, life is, I believe life is meant to be lived in as much joy as we can, but life is also contrast. Life is also up and down. I've lived enough of it now to know, and you can't lay down, you can't be shattered, you can't die and give up. You know, that's what my son did. You know, it's to be lived, it's to learn. So I still struggle with it, but you know, that's what I can say.
Yeah. How was the family holding up under this?
Well, again, when you have a family member who has been struggling with opioid addiction, you know, it was a good year of us knowing he was really in trouble and kind of ups and downs. And it wasn't a surprise again to the family. You know, you hope, okay, this is the time he's going to, this is the day that he's going to say, yeah, I can do this. I can get through. And so we, you know, we all wished the best for him and supported him and loved him. And yet we know that this was one of the, what could, might have happened, you know, and it did. So we love each other. You know, I have two 13-year-old twins that are just, they're just so clear, and they loved him so much and still do. And they're happy he's out of pain now, you know, and my oldest daughter, who was probably closest to him, you know, she struggles, but we help each other. And, you know, it's just about love. It's just about talking about it. It's just about, you know, being in the moment with it.
Well, you deserve all the credit in the world for pushing forward and projecting this much, again, strength. What's it been like to return to music in the face of this?
That's where all the healing is. Before his death, I had been doing a daily little concerts from my home. So much fun, you know, four songs. I was really getting into the, I was going deep in my catalog, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to do every song I've ever recorded. And I got really close to it. Hundreds of songs I was playing. And then when that happened, I stopped and I let go and I, you know, grieved. And after a few weeks, I was like, this is so hard for me. My release, the thing that makes life make sense, has always been my music. I have always been able to sing and breathe and let it out and get the emotions out through music. It has saved me my whole entire life. And I knew I started with, well, is that appropriate? How do I get in front of people now? How do I do that when, you know, they know this pain, they know what I'm going through. And so I, what my wife and I did the week after he died, we started coming out here in our garage. That's what this is our garage.
Wow.
And we created something we've dreamed of always, which is our own little studio. So we can, my wife is a television producer and creator. She created Nurse Jackie and all that stuff. And this was a place where we could make our dream come true of creating television around what I love to do, which is to sing. So we came out here every day, day after day after day, and just, we didn't know how it was going to work. We didn't know about lighting. We had to learn about cameras. We had to learn about streaming. We had to learn everything. And little by little, every day, we plug something in, figure something out, get a piece of equipment. My management helped fund a lot of this, and we put it all together, and I was able to do what I called the Heal Me concert, which was just a free concert. I said, look, this is what we're doing. I sang, I just got, it was just so, so healing for me. And then now we have turned it into something we call Etheridge TV, which is you can go to a website, etheridgetv.com. You can buy a subscription, and 5 days a week, there's live programming. There's three live shows where I perform for like an hour, like yesterday. I do covers on Tuesdays. Thursdays is deep tracks, and Saturdays is like big rock concert. And it's just me, and I'm looping, and I get to work my, I get to practice some of my music. I get to play my guitars. It gives us something to do every day to get through this time. And it's just really saved us.
No, they've been great. I watched you did an All Springsteen Day. And I got a big kick out of that.
Yesterday was Beatles Day.
Yeah.
I did an epic rendition of Hey Jude, you know. And it's just, it's music. It saves me. It fills me. It also, something I can give to others. It's an energy that I just could never live without. So I'm so grateful for it.
One thing I noticed about when you are performing these live stream things that other people seem to struggle with more is, and I think it may go back to your comfort of performing in all sorts of settings, performing in bars for years, but you are clearly able to get yourself into that place where you actually are on stage and performing for an audience rather than having that awkward bar of I'm in my garage, you know?
Yeah.
I felt like more than most people, you're able to do that.
Yeah, and that does come from having to play in a bar 5 nights a week to the bartender and the bouncer, you know, and that was it. And pretending and just saying, well, I'm going to pretend that there's thousands of people watching me. And you do it for your own enjoyment, and you do it to the level. I'm still not giving it all like I do when there's people jumping up and down in front of me. Yet my wife is here, and sometimes my daughter is here. I have like two, they give me an audience when I can. And I know in my head that there's, you know, 1,000 people watching. I know there is. So it gives me that place I can go. And I thank you. I appreciate that, because I know people want to be entertained. I don't think they just want to watch me sit in my bedroom and play the guitar. I think they want to be inspired. And that's my intention when I do these.
You played your first bar shows, I believe, in high school, right?
Or yeah. Is that, junior high. I was in...
Oh, wow.
God, the first bar I went to was with my father would come with me wherever I would go. So it wasn't like I was just hanging out in bars. But I was about 12 years old. And it was a country, you know, country western band. We called it country western back then in the 70s in Kansas. And, you know, that was the first. He would come with me, and like the first set, I'd get up and sing some Tammy Wynette songs, and then I'd go home. And then by the time I was 13, I was a full member of a band, and I'd play full gigs, you know, in bars and, you know, VFWs and Elks clubs and just wherever there was live music, I would play.
The full gritty roar of your voice, how long did that take to sort of arrive?
Well, I think when I was, I've listened to recordings of me when I was about 12 or 13. And I think mostly it came from singing other people's material. And by the time I had a choir teacher. I was also in choir. And she always said, well, I would put you in the back because your voice was so strange. So I think I always kind of had a kind of gravelly thing going on. But then the more I sang other people's songs, the more technique I had, and the more I realized, oh, I can do this with my voice. And I just sang all the time. So I was able to work on it.
I think well before Janis Joplin became a hero, it was actually Linda Ronstadt who was a sort of a female role model.
Yeah. It took me a while to understand Janis Joplin. It took me until I really became a young adult to understand. I thought she was screaming. It also took me to get into sort of the blues, the black blues women. That's when I totally understood what she was doing. When I started listening to, you know, Bessie Smith and you know, Odetta and just all these great singers, you know, the blues singers, and that's where rock and roll came from. And when I made that correlation, I went, oh, this is who I need to be listening to.
How close did you actually come to playing Janis Joplin in a biopic?
Pretty close. It it's funny. Hollywood is a weird place, you know. They kind of wanted to do Janis Joplin's story, but they kind of wanted to make it up, you know. They didn't really want the real story, and so it didn't work. You really have to. And her story still isn't told. There still isn't that great story of this woman who completely went against all female norms in the '60s, and presented this amazing, powerful thing that was frightening, and then just boop, just burned out, you know. And I still hope that someday it will be made. But I was taking acting lessons, and I was in it. We did a couple of screen tests and things like that, and it was written, and then it just went away, because that's the way Hollywood is. It just poof, it goes away.
That's one of the great lost projects, I think, because you're one of the few people alive. It's funny that my voice went out on that moment. You're one of the few people alive who could have, you know, credibly done the singing yourself.
Thank you.
They could get some young actress, but you know.
That's probably what they'll have to do is get someone to sing to the masters, because she's just so unique and individual, and you could probably get some great, you know, get like Tatiana Maslany to play her, you know, and then just use the masters, and it's just a story that should be told.
So you very dramatically kind of went off to Los Angeles in this very like sort of cinematic way when you're a young woman. Tell me about that sort of journey.
Well, I grew up in Kansas, you know, where all dreams, all you have is your dreams, you know, all you have is what you want to be. You know, I had played enough that I knew I could go out into the world and I could go to a restaurant or a bar or a club or something. I could make, you know, I could make, you know, $25 a night and I could live. You know, I knew I could do that. I knew I could go down, I could busk on the street and make enough money to live. So I didn't have that fear. So when I came out to Hollywood, I fortunately had an aunt who lived in Silver Lake. And I stayed on her couch for a while until I got up and out. But then when I got here, it was 1982, and all the places, I thought I'd go down to the Troubadour, you know, where Jackson Brown was. And by the time I got there in 1982, it was all hair bands and spandex, you know. And I'm like, oh, God, I don't fit in here. And you couldn't make any money in these places because everybody wanted to play them, so you had to pay to play. You had to pay to play. And so fortunately, I found work in women's bars around. So I was able to support myself, but I kept thinking, who's ever going to come see me and discover me if I'm in a women's bar? But there was the wife of my manager was friends with a soccer team. And it eventually, I mean, it took 5 years, but eventually, you know, the record business community found me, and Chris Blackwell, I had been turned down by everybody because they used to have to come out to the lesbian bars in 1984, which is not, you know, it's very hip now to go to a lesbian bar, but 1984, this is not something you wanted to do. And they would come out and see, and I saw presidents of companies. I was turned down by everybody. And finally, Chris Blackwell walks in, he hears four songs, Chris Blackwell from Island Records. He hears four songs and says, yeah, I don't know why you're not signed yet. Yeah, and he signs me and it's done.
Now, did you first make contact with the LGBTQ community in LA or was it in Boston or earlier? Were you first kind of like...
Well, the late 70s, you know, 79, 80 is when I first like went to my first gay bar. It was actually in Boston in 79. You know, and that was that's a crazy experience. I'd never, you know, for a girl from Kansas, it was, you know, really, I mean, it was fine. It was just a bunch of lesbians at a bar, but I'd never seen that many people who were like, oh, they're like me. And here we are in one place. And then it wasn't until I came out to LA and I moved down to Long Beach and started playing in Long Beach. And there was a strong, we certainly didn't call it LGBTQ back then. We just said the gay community. And it was the lesbian community and the gay community. And the lesbian community was really, really strong. The women's movement, it sort of came from that. And then the early 80s, when the AIDS crisis came, that's when we really started organizing and getting together, that the boys and the girls would get together and organize and make things happen because we needed to. We were fighting for our lives. And that's when I really became part of the LGBT community.
Surviving through decades, I've begun to think can be like at a certain point, it can start to feel like you're a time traveler, a very slow time traveler. Because, I mean, if you look at 2020 America and 1970s Kansas, the difference in visibility, acceptance, everything is just incalculable, I think.
Well, I have to give it up for Kansas. They're actually on a path now to really become much more progressive from the election that they just had. And they elected Johnson County in Kansas elected a lesbian Native American woman to represent them, you know, Charisse Davis.
Incredible.
That it was just amazing. And they're moving in more democratic ways. It's I coming from there, I know the Kansas people. I know, you know, they're good. They're God-fearing people. Yet there's a sense of we're not North and we're not South. I grew up, it was very integrated. It was black and white. I had one high school in my town, and so everybody went there, the better off and the poorer kids, and we had an army base, and those kids would come, so we had kind of this interesting flair of kids from around the world. So there's just a sense of live and let live there that I think is really going to show up in the next few years in Kansas. I think it's my dog. I think Kansas is going to, I have a whole lot of hope in Kansas. I don't see it as backward as maybe people think. Yes, my dog again.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then Kansas 2020 versus Kansas in the 70s again.
Yeah.
Progress.
Yeah.
And I think when around the time Chris Blackwell signed you, I think he said to you something like, "What are we going to do about the gay thing?" Right.
Well, it was the album was just about to come out, and it was the last meeting of everyone. I remember sitting at the room where everyone's at the table, and they're like, "Okay, well, it's going to come out, and you're going to tour this, you're going to do that. Well, what are we going to do about this gay thing?" I mean, it's like, well, I'm obviously gay. You signed me into gay bar. I have a girlfriend. I said, well, I don't ever want to live a lie. I can't pretend I have a boyfriend or pretend I'm something I'm not. I'm just not going to do that. And they said, well, that's okay, as long as you don't flag wave, whatever that meant. We didn't have the rainbow flag then. So, and then, you know, 4 years later, I came out, so, and started flag waving. But they were at that point, they were very supportive of it. They changed with the times, too.
You said no one actually in those intervening 4 years, no interviewer asked you the question. It just never came up.
I was actually thinking about this morning because I knew I was talking to Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And I remember my very first Rolling Stone interview. And I was always expecting someone to do their homework and find out that this bar, the Que Sera in Long Beach, was a lesbian bar. And maybe they would ask me some questions about that. And he did. He said, he said, you know, this bar you were in was a lesbian bar. I said, yes. And he said, and you have a very large lesbian following. I said, yes. And he said, one might assume that you're a lesbian. I said, one might, yes, you know. And and I left it there. And this was my first album. And I totally expected for him to out me. And the article never came out. So, So it was either someone on your end or it might have been my publicity company might have nixed it. I don't know, that behind my back, not telling me. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, a good Rolling Stone reporter did his homework, and the article never came out.
Huh. Yeah. Well, I'll we'll do some investigating.
Yeah, find out. It was 1988. There you go.
How did you come to be a Bruce Springsteen fan?
How does anyone come? You hear, you know, Blinded by the Light, and you're like, you know, that's it. Again, growing up in Kansas, we had a great radio station there called KY102. It was a rock station. And in like seventh grade, I was 12, 11, 12, right around there. I had mono. I was sick for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, just in bed. And my parents gave me their radio alarm clock because we didn't have a TV upstairs. And so for about 2 weeks straight, I listened to the radio, and I listened to it all day and all night, just listened to all this rock and roll stuff. And when they played Springsteen, I sat up and went, what is that? And then right after that, he came out with Born to Run. And of course, the minute you hear Born to Run, it's like, it's over. And that's when I was starting to form my idea of what kind of artist I wanted to be. I had started playing in these bands a little bit. I was messing around writing my own songs. I had this desire coming up inside of me, and I said, that's the kind of artist I want to be. I want to write songs that make people feel the way he makes me feel. I want to sing with this authenticity. I want to perform like that. I want, you know, people to when I play. And so it from then on, it was, what would Bruce do, you know?
What always struck me about your performance of Thunder Road with him at the Unplugged is that you were singing it in the classic way, And he at the time was in this ambivalent place. He wasn't fully rocking. He was a few years away from reuniting with the E Street Band. And it's like you could feel you're almost dragging him into the rock version. It's a really interesting tension there.
I got to tell you, he came to the show and we rehearsed upstairs in a little dressing room. We rehearsed, okay, you sing this. And I'm like, I'll just sing the second part. I'll just sing along with you. And so we go down for sound check and he goes, where's your band? I said, no, dude, it's just me and you. And he goes, you and I are just going to sing it? I said, yeah, this is unplugged. It's just me. I'm just playing, you know? And he's like, oh, and he kind of was like shaking. He hadn't done Tom Joad. He hadn't done anything yet. And his unplugged, you remember his unplugged was like, no. And he played it with the whole band.
Yeah, with the band. Yeah.
So he's like, looks at me and goes, and he watched the whole show, my whole show from the wings right there. He watched everything I did. And then he came out and sang it with me. And he'd never done that. To me, I thought everyone just gets up and says, that's fine. But he really, I appreciate you recognizing that because him and I, it was this great, it's one of my favorite things I've ever done, of course, is sing with Bruce Springsteen, but just the performance. And I kept messing up on the end, if you watch it, because I was like, dude, because I'd just been out, you know, out and proud for about a year. I said, I want to sing So Mary Climb In. That just really means a lot to me, right? And so, we'd get to the end, and I would just be so just staring at him and listening to him, and the line came, and I totally blew the line and messed it up. And he looked at me and I was like, oh, so we had to do it again. And you'll see, if you watch the performance at the very end, I almost blow it again. And I step up and sing, and I sing Mary Climb In, and the camera shot is right of him. And he turns and he kind of laughs because I almost blew it again. And it was just a great, memory.
The significance of that, of you getting to sing that line that hadn't occurred to me. That's spectacular. That's so cool. I wanted to talk about, you know, just go through some of your greatest hits, if you don't mind. I'm the Only One. Can you kind of recall how it came together and maybe talk about what it means to you now?
Well, I'm the Only One. I had three albums out by that time, and I was touring for the third album. And my career had sort of, I'd sold like almost a million albums each album, which is, you know, it's a gold record. It's a platinum record. It's great. And at the time, it was fine. But I just wanted more. I wanted to be played on more, a broader radio audience. And I was tired of trying to, the last album, Never Enough, I tried, there was these new things called samples, you know, that people were trying. And I kind of was trying that. And I'm like, look, I'm just going to get back to what I know, what I can do, rock and roll. And I sort of said, look at Bring Me Some Water. Bring Me Some Water off my first album. That's just an old Muddy Waters, get back, blues guitar riff that I played on it. So I said, you know what, I'm gonna go to the blues rock and roll again. And so I just a nice shuffle. And I said, that's what I'm gonna do. And I knew what I was gonna write about. I was very, the experience that I wrote about was already there. So I knew I wanted this, bluesy, damn, you broke my heart, but I'm going to, move through this. And I remember writing it. I wrote it on the back of the tour bus in Germany, I think. You know, I was touring in Europe, and I was just back in the bus just playing it and writing, and it came pretty easily.
When you hit a chorus like that, you must have known, the first time you sang it, you must have known you kind of had hit it.
Well, I knew I would want to sing it. And at that point, it's like, look, as long as I love it, as long as I want to sing the song, then hopefully other people will love it. And I tell you, it's to this day, people, they sing it. They sing it karaoke. It's great.
Of course. And Come to My Window.
Come to My Window was funny. I almost didn't put it on the album. I was like, I thought it was a little too ambiguous of a song that maybe people wouldn't quite know what I'm talking about. The chorus came first, actually. I wanted to write a chorus that had a lifting melody that kind of went up and just come to my window. Da 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 da. I wanted that, and I'll be home soon. I was like, oh, and then, and I wrote that in Europe too. I was in a relationship that was, you know, it's the kind of relationship you have in your early 30s that you think you're all in it, but it's all complicated. And so just the, I had just hung up from talking where we didn't say anything. We just were like, you know, it's just bad. And I just hung up and, you know, and said, why, you know, why do I do this? Oh, well, I would dial the numbers just to listen to your breath. I would just, you know, I want to connect with you so badly. So it was that sort of angst. And then the bridge that I don't care what they think. I don't care what they say. What do they know about this love anyway? It's like my excuse to be putting up with all of this, you know, with this bad relationship. It was just, I mean, this is what I want, you know, and then I put it all together, very simple. And then I was like, yeah, it's too, it was just, it wasn't quite what I, it certainly wasn't what I thought a hit song was. And then, man, it came out and it just kept going and going and going. I was like, oh, what do I know, you know?
And you can sleep while I drive.
Oh, now that song, that song, of course, it's funny, I wrote that in England. So I write a lot of songs when I'm overseas.
Yeah,
thinking
clearly you have to leave the country.
To write the best songs. I think I need to go now. That song was about missing America, actually. And a trip that I took when Chris Blackwell signed me, I was tired of everything. I said, well, I'm going to make my own tour. And I booked like little coffee houses. I called it up and said, hey, for $50, can I come play? And they're like, yeah. And so I just booked this thing and had enough gas money to go from town to town. And so this is a memory of that trip that we took, you know, staying with Barbara in Nashville. Again, I'm in a relationship that it wasn't monogamous, which I don't recommend that for anyone. But, you know, writing about this and writing about America. And I remember starting the first verse and writing, you know, come on, baby, let's get out of this town. I got a full tank of gas and the top rolled down. You know, there's a chill in my bones. I don't want to be left alone. So, baby, you can sleep while I drive. Okay, yeah. And I remember when I wrote you can sleep while I drive, I was like, oh, that's a really nice thing. And a lot of people don't know. A lot of people are like, oh, we played that song at our wedding. It's a very loving thing. If you listen to it, you know, you can sleep, I'll drive. But the song is about the fear of losing someone, of that person that's going to go be with someone else, you know. And at the end of the song, it's, well, if you won't take me with you, if you're going to go by yourself, if you won't take me with you, I'm going to go before the night's through and you can sleep while I drive.
Right.
And a lot of people don't catch that, but that's what it is.
Well, you know, there's people who think that With or Without You by U2 is a love song, you know?
Right. Oh, I know. Once you do a song, it's up to you. You can take it however you want.
Now, your most recent album, as I mentioned, the Medicine Show, is, first of all, really excellent. I think stands up with any of your work.
Oh, thank you.
But the Medicine Show idea, the medicine in question is, if correct me if I'm wrong, is cannabis.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, a few things. I mean, I guess you had an experience, and I think there's a lot of people who have had that, more and more have had that experience in recent years, which is you had a very large dose of edibles one time.
We call it a heroic dose. Yes. Yes. Unintentionally, my girlfriend at the time was a very good baker. And unbeknownst to me, she was just one of those people that if a little bit's good, then a lot is good for you. And so, you know, she didn't know how much cannabis to put in, and she they were delicious. So I ended up eating like 3 cannabis cookies. And of course she passed out and I was like, and this was before cancer. This was before anything. And it really popped my head open. And I think there's something in a heroic dose, whether it's cannabis or psilocybin or ayahuasca or whatever it is, that takes your left brain offline, your left brain, which is, you know, scientifically we know it's in charge of the future and the past and worrying about what you got to do. And it keeps you in balance of, you know, things that you got to do and standing up and moving forward. And it takes that offline. And then your right brain, which is all intuition and oneness and spirit and, you know, everything that we really don't make much time for in our lives. And all of a sudden that's everything. And I spent, you know, it seemed like forever, but I spent, you know, a good couple of hours really connected up with spirit, with that part of our brains, with that part of our existence, or part of our reality. And it just totally changed my life. I woke up the next morning and went, wow, I'm never going to be the same. Then I was diagnosed with cancer, and it really helped me walk through the cancer experience. Really helped me.
The experience helped you, or cannabis helped you, both?
The experience of that sort of spirituality helped me with, you know, something where I was looking at my mortality, thinking that I might die, you know, cancer. My father died of cancer. My aunt, my grandmother, oh my God, what if I die of cancer, you know? The experience of this heroic dose of cannabis just put me at ease about death. It's like, oh, we all die. Yet this spirit that we are, you know, this physical body, yeah, this, I call it a meat suit. This meat suit goes away. But man, this thing that's my spirit that is animating this, that's keeping me upright, that never goes away. So I don't fear death. And it's one of the reasons that my son's passing, I'm able to know that he's still with me. He's just in non-physical. You know, he doesn't end. That spirit is still there. I wish he was here in the physical with me, yes. But I know he's there just like my father. And I know that when this meat suit's done, I will still be here. So I don't, and once you remove that fear of death, that takes away a lot of reasons that we stop ourselves from doing things. So when I went through my cancer journey, I came at it with, I'm not going to fear death because I'm not afraid. And then I started looking at health and medicine. And that's one of the reasons I truly believe cannabis and plant medicine, entheogens are, we need them now. It's one of the, I think it's why people reach for opioids. It's the processed synthetic version of this pain relief, when plant medicine offers that to us. It offers a relief of our left brains that can just crush us in our problem solving consciousness, you know? And I'm a big supporter of plant medicine, and I'm involved in the cannabis industry, and yeah.
Did you get that phrase meat suit from Cross? Because I know he's used that.
From who?
From David Crosby.
Oh, no, I didn't. I got it from a journey I had, and one of the shamans called it your meat suit.
Well, that's that's a bizarre coincidence. Yeah, no.
I probably told him.
Right, that could be, because I never heard Cross say it directly. James Taylor told me that Cross calls it a meat suit. So there you go. Weird. He must have gotten from you.
He might have got it from me.
Have you been able to talk to Cross in all this? I know he's devastated.
Yeah, he's really sad. And you know, of course, he thinks that for somehow his own biology, you know, was part of of the reason that Beckett was, you know, addicted to opioids. But you can't. We all have that capacity to be addicted, you know? And he's such a beautiful man, and he really is. With all his, you know, quirks and everything that he is, he gave me an opportunity to be a parent, and I'm so grateful for that. And yeah, we've talked. He's a wonderful human being.
It does seem, you can imagine why he would say that, but it also, when you really think about it, it's too reductive.
Exactly.
To imagine that's the case. But you are, you know, like all musicians, again, you're off the road, and quite forcibly. How, and no one knows anything, but how hopeful are you that you can be playing in front of audiences anytime soon? Where does it sit in your mind?
Well, I've just come to the, I've lived long enough to know that things change, that what is will become something else. Like I could have never imagined what's going on now. It's funny because I always said, well, at least I can always sing for people. I can always sing for people. And then they took the people away. I'm like, oh gosh. So, you know, I'm doing it streaming now. I'm doing it online. Yet that experience of people in an audience live sharing the experience of music, the ritual of music, we need that. That's a human experience that makes this reality palatable. It makes it, I mean, there's people that really count on getting out there and doing that. So I totally believe that it will come back, because it's a human desire to be with other humans celebrating in music. We've done that since we were, you know, in the caves, you know. And I think we'll see it probably in the European countries. They'll come first because they're so far ahead of us right now. And they'll show us a way to do it, and then we'll start small. Are we going to see it this year? No. Is it going to be the last thing that comes together? Yes. You know, so I'm hoping. I truly believe that by next summer, we'll be out doing shows, because I can't imagine – well, I couldn't imagine this, but my belief is that, yes, we will be back to doing shows in the spring, summer of 2021.
The sense is increasingly, yeah, that whatever happens, the U.S. won't be first. You're not the first musician I've heard say that. And that wasn't the way we were thinking a few months ago, but it's now becoming, and tragedies upon tragedies, just, you know. And it may be also, personally, from my observation situation, that some of these countries have gotten it so in control might be able to have shows before vaccine, because there's no real community transmission. But in the U.S., it possibly might not be until a vaccine, because we can't seem to get the community transmission down. I don't know if you've thought about it in this degree of detail, but
no, I haven't. I'm ready to go move to New Zealand and play there in a couple of weeks, you know. You know, because it's sad, the lack of leadership that we had. It's tragic. And the repercussion, I mean, my crew, my band is out of work. I mean, lots of people are out of work. And these are, you know, skilled technicians. You know, we've set up a GoFundMe, for my crew. The fans have set it up, and we're trying to, you know, get them some funds. But it's just, it's really tragic. And I do hope that new leadership will help us get things going in 2021.
Absolutely. Well, I think this has been great. But Melissa, thank you so much for doing this. Again, it was great to see you. And again, you know, every condolence I can give.
Thank you.
But looking forward to your many performances that we're going to be getting.
5 nights a week here, 3 o'clock Pacific time, 6 o'clock Eastern time, right here. Playing music, talking. On Fridays, I show old videos of performances of me back in 1988 no one's ever seen. So we're having a really good time. Etheridge TV. And, you know, thank you. I look forward to having interviews in person again. That would be nice.
Me too. Thanks again. Stay safe.
You too. Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much to Melissa Etheridge. We'll be back next week, here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download Rolling Stone Music Now as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes if you can. I tend to read them. But as always, thanks for listening. Stay safe, and we will see you next week.